Norman Stories, written by Norman and read by Norman. I'd been a professional actor for over 50 years, and having just finished a long-running TV series, I decided, now that I'd grown up a bit, that I'd take my life into an entirely new direction. My children were grown up, had their own lives, and their own families. So with my lovely wife, Diane, I thought, now it's our time. I gave us that rare gift of choice. We both loved traveling, so we traveled and traveled and traveled, and then we traveled some more. Having always been an avid reader, I decided that I'd like to write. I had no idea that I wanted to write a novel or even an autobiography, but there were certain things in my life that I thought my children or grandchildren might find interesting or even amusing. So the first story I'm going to read is actually the first story I ever wrote. It's very early on in the Second World War, and I was 7 years old. And the British government had decided that they would evacuate all children from all the main cities in England for their safety. So the story is called Just Send Us Any Two. I was born in London into what's called the working class. My first word was goodbye. But the first wave and goodbye that I can remember was at the age of 7. Teachers had suddenly become nicer. Parents more patient and loving. And I was sent to school with a little cardboard box tied with a piece of string around my neck containing one gas mask, S, small, along with a banana or apple and sandwiches, and a large label tied on my jacket lapel, ready to go on a lovely trip, which was, in fact, to be evacuated from Hitler's threatened bombing and gassing. When the day did arrive, much to our surprise, mothers burst into tears, and dads looked down. The kids, ignoring all this, had a marvellous time, screaming at the tops of their voices, running up and down the stairs of the line of the double-decker buses, which was to take them to Waterloo Station. Like everybody at that time, we did what we were told, and believed what we were told. After all, it was only going to be for a very short time, and was going to be a lovely holiday. Most of us didn't come back for over 5 years, and during that time we saw very little of our parents, and some did not have a marvellous time. My brother and I were two of the lucky ones, though this was our second attempt at evacuation. The first to Bedford had lasted only a few weeks when our mother, who came to visit us, took one look at the spots on our bodies, the dirt and the snot that was always dripping off that end of that woman's witch-like nose. And we were on the next train back. But this time she knew it would be different, and it was. When we arrived at Waterloo Station, it seemed that every child in London was trying to meet under the clock, with the same suitcase and label. A whole generation of knees, macs and caps weaving their way like caterpillars, being hissed at by giant trains, complaining their way in and out of the station, steam swirling around the glass-domed roof. This was our first marketplace of the day, with parents pursuing children for one last wave before they left. And left, we all did. By some miraculous weaving and waving and Great Western Railway planning, we sat in our carriage, having eaten everything we'd brought in the first 5 minutes, on our way to Bath. On our arrival, we were met by an army of WVS workers, Women's Voluntary Service, who marched us up to the top of the hill and then marched us down again. Eventually, we were ushered into a small school playground, our second marketplace of the day. It was hot, noisy, and dry. But we were rescued by a very gallant, stiff Englishman of the gentry, the first I'd ever met and later became familiar with only from a distance during my evacuation. I was occasionally allowed to work for them, in their gardens or on their farms, or as a beater. You had to make a lot of noise and wave your arms about, and the rabbits and hares and pheasants would run towards the guns, which were lined up on the other side of the field. And as they would come out of their feet, I don't think the rabbits thought it very sporting. You were paid 6 pence an hour for all work, 30 shillings for a 60-hour week. Our friend lined us up on the pavement, clapped his hands, and called, "James, my car." And a car appeared, with James, and about 8 of us scrambled in. Now, this was my first time in the country, ever, and I was terrified. I can still remember the fear when we stopped for a pee. Those cows, with enormous, wild, staring eyes, through the thin wire fence, only a few feet away. Horns at the ready, about to charge, teeth that would munch up a 7-year-old in 2 minutes flat. There seemed to be thousands of them, all with their eyes on me. The lovely time had gone. I'd had enough, and I wanted to go home. Wiltshire across the Downs was like a bleak green desert, and nobody seemed to live there, or even want to. I was scared and tired, and suddenly everything and everyone was silent. Chitten, when we arrived, was asleep, even though it was still light. No cars, no people, just funny little houses on a narrow street. It had come upon us suddenly, as it lies in a valley, and from any distance seems covered with trees, like a cover for the sleeper. We were driven straight to Judge Brown's, a large house, one of the largest in the village, with well-kept flower beds and lawns, and a heavy front door. The judge who came out to meet us was a kindly old man who looked a bit like J.B. Priestley. Taking us by the hand, we followed him into the sitting room with our cases, gas masks, and labels. The room was heavy with oak furniture, plush cushions, oriental rugs, huge clocks, and pictures that hung from every wall. There were French windows that opened out onto a well-tended garden. It was another world, foreign and overpowering. We could do nothing, say nothing, or even think nothing, only nod our heads when we were asked if we would like a glass of lemonade, which was brought in by his wife on a large silver tray. As we sat in a row, noises had taken over. Birds in the summer evening, clocks ticking and chiming, and politely being asked unanswerable questions, which made us look at the floor. The occasional clonk as someone kicked the leg of his chair with a nervous foot. We sat in this agony, as if forever, only being reminded of the time when the grandfather clock hit the quarters and made us all jump. By this time, we'd all been left alone to rest. Please, call us should you need anything. If we should need anything. We sat wanting nothing except to turn the clock back so we could go to that hideous Victorian school with our gas masks and forget that today had ever happened. Voices were now heard again in the hall, more and more, whispering and constantly conspiring. What did they want with us? What had we done wrong? And where were our parents? The door suddenly opened, and led by Judge Brown, In walked the strangest flock of men and women I'd ever seen, all clean and shiny, the men with their caps in their hands and their heavy boots that shone like their bowed faces. The women, short and stocky, scarves on their heads, and no lipstick, who seemed more nervous than the men, if that was possible. They entered the room as if it was a minefield, their backs clinging to the wall, and like us, they were out of their place. Judge Brown spluttered something about, "I'll leave it to you, then." And the picking began. We were in the marketplace for the third time that day. "I love that one with the curly hair," said one, in an accent we could hardly understand. "That one looks sweet. The one with the blue eyes, I'll have him." When they'd all finished, I realized that no one had picked me or my brother. I found out afterwards that we came as a pair. As panic overcame me, I wanted to take hold of a friend's hand and ask him to take us with him, anywhere, than to be turned out into the fields with those animals, which now must surely happen. But no one looked our way. We were ignored, to be dealt with later. Our friends could only pick up their cases and leave without so much as a look back. The door closed, and we were alone again. I started to cry. My brother, who was 2 years older than me and very bossy, couldn't even bring himself to tell me to shut up. The ticking clock, my sniffling, was all that was left. It was getting dark outside, so we couldn't even find our own way back. After a long period of numbness and feeling utterly alone, the door opened and a young man of about 17 entered. He lifted up our cases and with a wink said, "Here, you must be very tired. Come along with me. We'll soon put you right." We trailed after him through the village in the dusk until we came to a small cottage on the green, a few doors from the church. As we went up the garden path through a mass of coloured flowers which grew over my head, I saw a face peeping from behind the curtains of an upstairs bedroom window. A boy's face. The cottage door opened, and the kindest smile I'd ever seen was looking down on us, with another as kind and as gentle and clear, looking over her shoulder. It was Mr. and Mrs. Windsor. Putting their hands gently on our shoulders, they took us into their house and ushered us into their lives. They thanked boy George and said, "All right, we'll take him from here." We came into the small best room, which smelt of geranium plants and summer dryness. They took us through to the kitchen where we washed in a tin bowl filled with cold water from an enamelled jug that in turn had been filled with soft, cold water from the well. We ate a boiled egg, laid that day, which ended up splattered all over the table as I tried to open my first egg. "Ain't ever seen anyone try to open an egg like that before," they laughed. And when I nearly fell asleep in the corner, they told me to get off to bed and handed me a candle, which I took promptly and walked into the larder, closing the door behind me. They led me out, still laughing. "We got a queer one here," they said. I must have seemed as queer to them as they did to me. My brother and I lived 5 years with this family, and I considered it to be an honour. They wouldn't come to the judge's house. They said, "They're children, not cattle. Just send us any two."